Now on Documentary on News Talk, producer Fergal McCarthy explores the issue of bonded labour among the Christian minority in Pakistan and examines the work of the Columban Fathers of Ireland in their tireless efforts to free these communities from this form of modern-day slavery. In Bonded Labour, Pakistan's Christian Minority.
This is Karachi City, in the Sindh province of Pakistan, a sprawling city of over 20 million people, just before daybreak and the morning call to prayer. We're here with Father Tomás King, a native of County Galway and a member of the Columban Fathers. Tomás has been a parish priest in the Sindh province of Pakistan for over two decades.
From East Galway, grew up on a farm there. Postal address is actually Chome, but I'd be probably near Athenry. I went to secondary school in Athenry till Intercert. Intercert in the summer of 79. That summer my father also died, so I stayed at home on the farm for 5 years until I was 21, and then I joined the Columbans. About 5 years of farming before taking the easy life.
Taking the easy life meant signing up to a lifetime of missionary work with the Columban Fathers.
In the year it was my turn to go, there was two options available, Korea or Pakistan. So I opted for Pakistan of those two. Columbans first came to Pakistan in a team of six people in 1979 to Lahore Diocese. After, you know, studying language for some time, they started working in parishes as a way of, you know, getting into parish ministry, which is a good way of entering into the life and culture of the people, especially the Christian minority people, to get an appreciation of the local church, the local culture, society, and especially from the perspective of a poor, oppressed minority, as the Christians, in most of the Christians in Pakistan are.
The Christians of Pakistan are considered to be the lowest rung of Pakistani society, so low that they're not even considered a part of the traditional Hindu caste system.
Primarily, the background would be sweepers, you know, low-caste Hindus, low-caste within the Hindu system, outside the pale, if you like, very much oppressed because of the work that they did, cleaning the streets, the sewers, you know, it was considered very dirty, and that's been there for a millennium. That has been there for a very, very long time, going back to the Indus civilization in 3000 BC.
Because of the work they do, cleaning streets, sewers and elsewhere, they're often referred to as the untouchables. One of the main Christian communities that Tomás works with is the Parki Koli people, a community, an ethnic group, that was originally Hindu but is today mostly Christian. Many would have converted during the British colonial period. Once that period came to an end, this group found themselves not only one of the poorest groups in the country, but also of a religion that ran against the country's national identity. It was here that the Columban saw the opportunity to be involved, to be a part of this community.
There was intention, you know, there was a focus, there was a hope and a vision to get involved in interfaith dialogue, especially, you know, to engage with the whole reality of Islam. You know, it was one of the reasons why Pakistan was chosen. It's a difficult ministry, but a necessary ministry. You know, if religions are to be a power for good, you know, they have to engage with each other, because the problems, the challenges facing today's world are too serious. You know, from the ecological crisis, you know, to the fundamentalism, which is causing a lot of death, especially this part of the world. Poverty, you know, the gap between the rich and poor countries, rich and poor peoples. If religions are to be part of the solution, they need to engage with each other and become part of the solution, and to give witness that there is a more humane, a more peaceful, a more prophetic way of doing it. That was, you know, to do that in a small little way in a place like Pakistan would have been one intention.
To do this, the Columbans provide a number of services to these communities, from schools, housing and healthcare. But one of the most important issues that they assist with is the issue of bonded labour, basically a form of modern-day slavery. So what is bonded labour? If you're poor in Pakistan, often your only access to credit or a cash advance is through a loan from the farm owner that you work for. Poor communities, such as the Páirc Uí Chaoilí people, are particularly vulnerable to this situation. Living on less than a couple of dollars a day, these debts never get repaid. Also, many of these workers can't read or write, so it's easy for the landowner to fudge the numbers and keep the labourer forever in debt. Today, we travel out of Karachi City and into the interior of Sindh province, to a town called Badin, an area where the issue of bonded labour is at its worst.
So we're leaving Karachi early morning for a town called Badin, 200 kilometres away. It's a sugarcane cutting season, so a lot of trucks of sugarcane will be on the road. Just passing through the town of Tata. This is historic because it's where Islam was introduced into the subcontinent across from the Arabian Peninsula around the year 711.
From these early beginnings, today, Pakistan is considered to be one of the most Muslim countries in the world.
The usual figures quoted are 96% Muslim, maybe 2% Christian, almost 2% Hindu, and some very small minorities like Parsi, Sikh, but overwhelmingly majority would be Muslim. The population of the country, it's been a few years since there's been a census, but there's been around 180 million and growing. It's divided into four provinces. There's four main provinces of the country. The Punjab, which is the largest economically and also population-wise the largest. Then Sindh, the province that we're in at the moment, which has Karachi, with a population of an estimated 20 million people. The Balochistan province on the west, touching Iran and Afghanistan. On the north, Pakhtunkhwa province. That's a difficult term, it's only newly named. It used to be called the Northwest Frontier. That's touching Afghanistan and Iran also. And then there's areas in the north called tribal areas. They're kind of basically autonomous. They touch China and India. The northern areas where the main activity was going on as regards Al-Qaeda and Taliban, that's where we'll be heard in the west mostly, from those particular parts of the country. So the part of the Sindh that we're in, part of the country, interior Sindh, would traditionally be considered the more peaceful part of the country. Islam and Sindh would have been influenced by the Sufi tradition, which is a mystical tradition. So it would be, I suppose, to be fair to say, a gentler form of Islam, you know, that maybe many people in the West don't know about or hear about these days with all the other side of things going on, the Al-Qaeda-Taliban interpretation. Because at heart, Islam would be considered a very peaceful religion, but obviously that's not the way it's understood today with some organisations.
We arrive in Badin. The church complex is a large open compound. From here, the church provides a number of services for the local community. A primary school, a secondary school, a medical clinic and more. Although the school has a Christian ethos, all of these services are offered to the local community regardless of their background. The medical clinic specialises in the issue of TB. Tomás shows us around.
Shivo. So this is the entrance to the TB clinic. And tuberculosis. There's three parts, a little laboratory, doctor's consulting room, also where the patients get the medicines from the lab technician and the nurse. So this is the laboratory. This is Peter, lab technician.
Yes.
Tell me, the kya hota hai laboratory?
Ye hamari TB lab hai. Yahan pe hum sputum check karte hain, jo jis pe TB zahir hoti hai.
The basic purpose of this is the laboratory. The basic purpose of the laboratory is sputum testing. That's one of the ways of diagnosing TB. So process kya se karte hain?
Tarikikar yahi hota hai ki hamara pehle jo na jagah naya.
So when there's somebody thinks they have TB or the, you know, the possibility of having TB, the first thing they do, first the sputum test, then onto the X-ray, and both are used to confirm if there's TB or not. And then they meet the doctor, who we'll meet later, and he gives the medicine regime. Naamahinika course. It's an 8-month course. So the doctor decides after the diagnosis, you know, what this particular patient's regime should be.
TB is often regarded as the sickness of the poor, hence why it's currently so rampant throughout Pakistan. It's also very contagious, so always an uphill battle keeping the disease in check. The next day, we travel a couple of hours outside of Benin to a town called Motley. Here, we'll visit our first Christian colony, basically a small village that's been set up on land owned by the church. These homes are offered up for free to families that find themselves trapped in bonded labour, therefore giving them a place to go. Getting them off the farm owner's land and out from under his control is the first step in achieving their freedom.
Okay, now we're walking through the Christian colony, just outside the parish compound in Motley. There are about 80 families entirely along this stretch, and they comprise all of the Christian community in the town itself, you know. The people are here because they were given plots of land by the church as a means to get the people off the land, free from bonded labour. And this is all church land. So they have the freedom and the luxury of having a place to stay that's not owned by a landlord. They can build a life, they can live there, for generations, you know. And now, in some cases, we are into the second and third generation.
Using a law that already exists on the Pakistani law books, but rarely enforced, a law that outlaws one person giving an advance to another, Tomas and his colleagues are able to legally break the control that the landowner has over the farm labourer.
So when I came here first in 1993, most of these houses were mud houses. There was very few brick houses at that stage, so most of the people had just arrived. And they started off just making a basic mud house, then gradually built up as they got, work around the town. But gradually, as they got better jobs, as they got work, kids got education, they built brick houses. Then children got married, sons got married and built on further rooms. So the number of nuclear families is building up all the time. But from one generation to the next, education has made a big impact, They're in here, can go to the church primary school, government high school in the town afterwards. And obviously they get, the children get better jobs. And they have, by and large, made a better life for themselves. Some continue to work on the land as labourers, but they're not bonded because they're on their own plot of land. That's a very significant, important piece of reality. Because once they're sitting on landlord's land, they're under his control,
Have you ever had landlords come looking for bonded labourers that you would release?
Yes, I mean, that they did come many times to try and take back their bonded labourers. There was one occasion in 98 where the bonded labour camp was in full swing, where the trucks came at night time with henchmen of the landlord and kidnapped the people and took them away, kidnapped truckloads of the labourers who used to work for them. But after a few days of agitation, a few days campaigning, protests, and the public opinion, especially because it made a lot of media attention, the people were freed. And now new families continue to come. People to stay on the land, it means staying in bonded labour, This is one way that a small, relatively speaking, a small group of people were helped to make the break. And it was, it's been tried in other places as well, in other parishes. There has been, church land has been used to set up colonies. I suppose the downside, maybe, Lebanon is not perfect, but there can be a little bit of ghettoisation. But that happens with minorities anyway, when a minority feels small and secure, they tend to try to stay together as much as possible. That's what happens here. By and large, especially interior Sindh here, but there, generally in the ordinary everyday life of people, there are good relations. People get on with their lives. They work together. The painters we just met along the way there, we greeted. They're painting houses for Muslims, But they depend on their Muslim neighbours, for work and things like that. By and large, in a place like Motley, it's okay. There are good relations.
Back at the compound in Benin, Tomas reflects on life living in Pakistan. Not just as a Westerner, but as a Catholic priest. What's it like living under the cloud of all the recent events in the region? the war next door in Afghanistan, the continued drone strikes, and the reality of a Pakistani Taliban.
There's really always something happening, you know, from back 25 years ago, the first Gulf War, that had an impact here. 9/11, you know, that had a massive impact here, you know, when the Western forces invaded Afghanistan to get at the Taliban. The second Gulf War, the West invaded Iraq. Those cartoons against the Prophet, which, you know, there's a lot of protests by mostly fundamentalists here, you know. The blasphemy law, you know, there's many instances of churches attacked down the years. All of those events right down the years, and now that, you know, as you mentioned, the drone attacks, there's always kind of something going on, you know. So there's always something that makes interfaith dialogue difficult. You know, some people say it's pointless. Some people say that, you know, how can you dialogue with such, you know, such negative realities, you know. And that is true to a certain extent. That is true. That is very difficult to dialogue with. But, you know, there is another reality to a place like Pakistan. Most of the people, you know, do not support Taliban or the Al-Qaeda. You know, they mightn't say it publicly, or there might be fear around it. Most people here do want peace. Most people want to send their children to school. They want the best for their children. The people that have been meeting them in the villages, they just want to have a good life for themselves, to have their own hopes and aspirations filled. And it is difficult to do that here in this context with so much happening, you know, with so much negativity happening. There are communities living together, by and large, in harmony and peace, you know, getting on with life and struggling with life, because most of those people would be from the poor strata of society. So that interfaith dialogue is happening in the ordinary everyday life events as a struggle to make a better life for themselves. Those big international events I mentioned, you know, and that caused an impact here, I don't feel unsafe. I feel safe travelling around. We can walk out on the streets, you know, get on with life normally. Okay, there are tensions and there are difficulties, but I don't go around in a state of fear, you know. I suppose it is easier as a man. You know, I'm dressed in the local dress. I do blend in a little bit because of complexion. So, you know, we're not living in a state of fear, but there is an atmosphere around, you know. There is, you know, it's hard to describe, you know. That doesn't make life easy. Maybe it comes from, you know, so many people having to struggle, you know, that brings a harshness, an edge to life that can come to the surface at times and cause, you know, just maybe be a bit violent.
The Parky Koli culture is at its most colourful during the wedding season. Traditionally, the wedding season follows the end of the sugarcane harvest, a time when farm workers have a little money. Tomas manages to get us an invite to a traditional Parky Koli wedding. Three weddings, in fact, all being held in the one day. In return, Tomas has been asked to preside over one of the ceremonies.
99.9% are still arranged marriages. There's still only occasionally what's called a love marriage, where a young couple fall in love and manage to persuade the parents to go along with it. Still very, very infrequent.
The wedding doesn't take place in the church, but instead amongst the cluster of mud houses of the extended families. They erect a temporary canopy of sorts where the ceremony will take place. Although the ceremony is a Christian ceremony, it also incorporates many Hindu traditions, as well as the tribal traditions of the Parky Koli people.
The catechist was just given the pointer to where to make the what's called mudwa. It's probably, I suppose, the best translation would be canopy, and which they will put up, you know, four posts. It's about 6 foot square, 6 by 6 by 6 by 6. It's within this that the final ritual will be carried out, the actual wedding ritual itself. In the centre, there will be put a cross and a lighted candle. You know, in the Hindu ritual, it would be a statue of Ganesh, one of the Hindu gods, plus an oil lamp. So the bride and groom, the bride, hands will be tied together, and the bride will be lead the boy around twice or three times, and then the boy will lead the girl around maybe once. And that is actually the commitment of the couple. You know, they don't exchange vows as we traditionally know it. Both couples put a hand on the Bible to signify their consent to each other, and then they lead each other on the candle. Going around the fire is the traditional Hindu way of expressing consent and then making the vows. So in that sense, the church has taken on those, you know, respects the local customs and has enculturated or incarnated or made them part of the wedding ritual, you know. It's in the colour of the local culture. It's in the custom of the local culture. It's in the tradition of the local culture. Because they are beautiful rituals, you know. They, if they're life-giving, if they're affirming, you know, then they should be kept going rather than, you know, not come in from the outside and say, this is wrong, this is not the way to do it, you know. People are oppressed for centuries. And here is something that's important to them has been affirmed, you know. So that for them is a very positive thing, you know. That says to them that they matter. When their rituals and ways of doing things are taken seriously, they themselves as a people are taken seriously. And wider society doesn't generally do that. And probably if they're oppressed in one way, they have to express themselves, you know. The wedding season for them is a joyful season, even though they might be living in poverty, even though they might celebrate a bit too much in the sense that more than their means can afford in some ways. But yet, you know, it's only once a year we have this wedding season, you know. It's not often that we have an opportunity to celebrate, so let's make the most of it, you know. You know, especially when their lives can be so painful and so oppressive.
वसन करो पूरा दयालु प्रभु वसन करो पूरा.
The following day, we continue travelling into the interior of Sindh province. Tomas brings us to another Christian colony in the town of Khatri. Just like the colony in Motley, this community is also made up of families that have been freed from bonded labour. In addition to all the other hardships that these communities face in Pakistan, this particular community was badly affected by the floods of 2010 and 2011.
So what we see here is 24 houses, two-roomed houses, little kitchen, bathroom, for 24 families, flood victims' families, for the floods of 2010-2011. They're a mixture of families of Muslim, Hindu, Christian. Columbus received a lot of funds from many different parts of the world, received a lot of money from Ireland. Again, the Irish people were extremely generous, you know, to donate a lot to the floods those 2 years. So the Columbus and the Spiritans got together. We worked together to put this housing in place. During the floods themselves, the immediate need is emergency help, food, shelter, you know, basic shelter. And then they received, you know, ongoing rehabilitation. We're up now on the banks of a canal, a very large canal. But the people used to live down here, down lower down where the land is, and they were completely flooded out. You know, the floods had covered all of this area, all this land, and all these crops were ruined at the time. So after negotiation with the people, you know, what they wanted themselves, so it was decided it was better to move them up here. They will not get flooded here. You know, it would have to be an extremely high flood, you know, to touch these houses in the future.
After leaving Khatri, we catch an overnight train north to the Punjab province and the city of Lahore. Unlike the Sindh province, where bonded labour is usually found on large farms, in the Punjab, bonded labour is usually found on brickfields or brick kilns, basically a place where bricks are made by hand. It's on these brickfields that Tomas and the Columban Fathers continue their work, freeing these workers from the clutches of bonded labour.
You're listening to Bonded Labour, Pakistan's Christian Minority, on Documentary on News Talk.
Yeah, we're on the train up to Lahore. If it's on time, it should take 16 hours. We'll be moving from Sindh province to the northern province of the Punjab. We'll be moving into the province which economically is the most wealthy. Population-wise, it's around 60% of Pakistan. 6 to 7 million people possibly, even though there hasn't been a census done in recent times. Punj is a Punjabi word for five. Ab is a Punjabi word for water. So it's the land of five waters. There are five rivers running through the Punjab. Punjab would also be, have the largest number of brick kilns, the largest number of factories. The mother tongue of the people is, as the name suggests, is Punjabi. The Punjab is also a divided province, because there's Punjab in Pakistan and there's Punjab in India. Even though they speak a common language, they're divided by partition, which has been a consequence of colonialism in many parts of the world, from Ireland, Timor, Kuwait, Iraq, Palestine, Israel, I suppose many also in Africa. So Punjab province of Pakistan is a partition province, partition people, like the Parker Coleries we've seen in Sindh. Some are in India, some are in Pakistan. So partition is also a theme of the history of this subcontinent.
We travelled through the night, arriving into Lahore early morning. While in Lahore, Father Liam O'Callaghan will be showing us around. Liam is also a member of the Columban Fathers. Like Tomás in Sindh, Liam works on behalf of the Christian community in the Punjab province, especially those who find themselves trapped in bonded labour. Liam brings us to our first brickfield, in a village called Jayabaga, about an hour south of Lahore city. The owner of the brickfield isn't on site today, so we have a chance to speak with some of the kiln workers. Although the Columban Fathers have freed thousands from bonded labour, the labourers that we'll be meeting today have yet to make the break from the brick kiln owner.
आपकी जिंदगी कैसी है अगर आप अपनी जिंदगी के बारे में यहां काम करते हुए किस किस्म की है
जिंदगी सही है जी काम कर रहे हैं तो मुश्किल ही है थे
कोई मुश्किल नहीं है
नहीं मुश्किल है जी मुश्किल क्यों नहीं
मुश्किल मुश्किलात क्या हैं
मुश्किल आ अभी आप पट्टे पे बैठे हैं काम कर रहे हैं
he says that the biggest problem we have is the debts that's everybody's problem here everybody has a problem of debt वो पूछ रहे ये किस तरह हुआ है कर्ज किस तरह हुआ क्यों दिया किसने दिया
कर्जा की बस इसी तरह ही मसलन कुछ कर्ज इस तरह ही बन बुन जाते हैं
काम राइट नाउ बिकॉज ऑफ द वेदर देयर हैज बीन नो वर्क फॉर मेबी दो माह फॉर टू मंथ्स देयर हैज बीन नो वर्क एट ऑल सो दे हैव नो मनी सो दे हैव टू बोरो जस्ट टू सर्वाइव Because of the rain, you simply cannot work with the mud, the clay in rain. So therefore, you simply can't make them. And even if bricks have been made, the rain can actually damage them. So it's an all around loss in the process. So there's no work at all for the last 2 months. The kiln has been actually closed, and they've built up more and more debts. They've got to pay electricity bills. They've got to buy food. So they've had to take loans. Even in the meantime, just to survive. Also, the different reasons. It could be if somebody gets sick, you know, bills and weddings, obviously, shadi and kiri. So they just keep on borrowing and it keeps on growing. And they never ever manage then to pay it back.
We ask what sums of money are involved in these debts.
He says it varies, but it's around, it could be 100,000 for one family, 500,000, maybe 600,000 rupees, which is equivalent of $1,000, $5,000, $6,000 of a family debt, which is simply unpayable, what they earn. It's really, really hard work. 12-13 hours of work per day. So it takes two workers to make 1,000 bricks in a day, roughly. And for that 1,000 bricks, they will get 740 rupees, which is just over $7. Or bazaar mein ye 1,000 in kitne?
Par yahan to 7,000 ho ja rahi.
Inna deni ye to patthe to ke bazaar mein 10,000 nu ve.
Theek. So that 1,000 bricks to purchase in the bazaar is roughly nearly 10,000. So it's 10,000 for sale to the builders, and they get 740 for making it.
ਨਾ ਕੋਈ ਸਾਡੇ ਕੋਲ ਟੀਚਰ ਆਵੇ, ਨਾ ਸਾਡੇ ਕੋਲ ਕੋਈ ਸਕੂਲ ਦਾ ਇੰਤਜ਼ਾਮ ਹੋਵੇ, ਨਾ ਹੀ ਇਹ ਬੱਚੇ ਖੁਦਾ ਦਾ ਕਲਾਮ ਪੜ੍ਹਨ ਜੋਗੇ ਚਲੋ ਜਾਣ।
It's just talking about the children and also the education, so they're saying that from here, from this killing, none of them are going to school, none of them are educated, simply because they're all having to work, and also that young children, small children, are kind of specially needed because their small hands are quite good for turning the bricks to get them to dry without damaging. So the young children have that job as well. So in this particular killing, all of these families' children, none of them at the moment are going to school. So as young as 5 or 6 years of age, they are doing this work. So children start very young. So ab kyu shift karte char 5 saal ke baad kya tar malik ke saath kaun si baat hoti hai
wo paise tarah de engine ke de jata
haan ji he says that when they shift, he's been here for 5 years, but they usually shift every few years, 4 or 5 years, but when they move on to a new killing, the debt goes with them, and the new owner of the new killing will just simply take up the same as it was before, and they will still owe that debt, but to a new owner.
Are they being sold? Is that what they're saying?
Wo pucho yel wo kehte hai, mujhe lagta hai ki ye aapko bech rahe ek malik
ji.
He says yes, that's exactly it, that we are being sold, that he simply writes a little chit, a note, and that goes on to the next killing owner, and the debt just continues on. So you're right, that's exactly what it is. We're being sold from one brick killing owner to the next.
The brickfield site is a huge open area with field after field laid out with thousands of bricks, all drying in the sun until they're ready to be baked.
So we have just 2 molds here for making the bricks. The mud is put into that, leveled off on top, and then simply turned over, left in the sun to dry. So this is the mold that the family are working with all day, making up to 1,000 bricks. So this is how he just kneads the clay. He's mixing with his hands, and then he's going to fit it into the mold. So this is the process of making one brick. So now once it's just ready, he'll level it off on top and then just turn it over. He says he and his wife, he has 6 children, and at best they can make maybe 1,000 up to 1,200 bricks a day. And that includes mixing that clay the night before, 2 or 3 hours the night before, so that it's ready for the morning to be worked on like this. So all day long it takes them full day's work just to get 1,000 bricks. And that will, as you say, an income of 740 rupees.
At this particular brickfield, work is on hold, so the kiln isn't actually firing right now. To give us a better idea of how the brick making process works, Tomas brings us to another kiln that's in the middle of the process.
We're standing right over the kiln, right on the fire, and the fire is down inside, in between the rows of bricks. That's covered with the soil, and then there's, it's like little chimneys made along the little openings for the fire to be filled. With the throwing the fuel, it's like little caps on an oven. You open the oven, and the fire is going between the rows of bricks, and they fire the bricks, bake the bricks, literally. You can see this is very, very hot. Just leaving the saucepan of tea, boils the water for the tea, and within seconds, it's so hot.
Standing on top of the kiln, the heat is unbelievable. To be able to work on top of the kiln, the workers wear sandals with thick, hard wooden soles.
This, the clog, wooden clog, is about 1 inch thick. It says it's still, the heat manages to come through. Here they're using coal to fire the bricks. There's a row of openings to throw in the fuel. They each has a cap. The cap has a hook, and they have a long hook in their hand to lift up the cap. Then they have a trowel. Get a trowel and fill the trowel with a shovel with coal, and just throw it in. Put back on the cap. Go on to the next one. Kitne der lagte pakane mein?
24 ghante lagte hain 21000
24 hours per 1,000 bricks, he says, yeah? I have no idea what the temperature is, but it is extremely hot. So you can put that together then in the height of the summer, 40 plus degrees when people are working on this during the summer. It's, you know, it is labour intensive, it is very difficult work and in a very hot climate, you know, so the, you know, people are hard working, you know, people have to work very hard to eke out a living. I read somewhere some psychologists wrote, you know, I don't often quote psychologists, but this one seems to have a good insight. Our biography becomes our biology. The pain and suffering and oppression that these people have suffered for generations and for centuries and for a millennium, it becomes so deeply embedded, it becomes part of the muscle, the skin, the bone, the blood, you know, it's part of the body. That, you know, and for that to be healed will take a long, long time. People, in my experience of working with people, people are as gifted and as talented as people you meet anywhere. The opportunities have been blocked, the oppression and discrimination and poverty has blocked that giftedness, have been allowed to flourish. They haven't got the education or the space to allow to flourish. It is difficult to appreciate deeply the impact on the psychic of a people, you know, on the centuries of oppression. When you're centuries at the bottom of the heap being told, you know, society telling you that you're no good, that you've been living in debt, oppression, in that situation for a long, long time.
को वेलकम कहते हैं आपके आने से तशरीफ लाने से हर सुबह.
The following day, Tomas brings us to another brick kiln in Sheikhupura, a city just northwest of Lahore. But this brick kiln is different. On this kiln, a school has been set up for the children of the labourers. With the help of the Columban fathers, the school is run by one of the local teachers, Miss Razia Siddiq. Instead of working backbreaking 12-hour days, these children get a solid basic education, an education that in time will allow them to go on to the government primary school in the centre of town.
Kitne bachche hain?
Idhar school mein 70.
There are 70 children in the school, in this brick kiln school. This school is right on the brick kiln. Miss Razia started. Kitne saal ho gaye?
Takriban mujhe 8 saal ho chuke.
It's 8 years. The school is going for 8 years. Ye sare brick kiln se hain na?
Sare bhatake bache hain.
All children from the brick kiln, from the brick kilns. Some from this one and some from the neighboring one. Dusre se bhi aate hain na? And some from the neighboring ones nearby.
Takriban 4 bhatto ke log hain.
From 4 separate brick kilns.
Idhar isliye aayi thi kyunki meri beti jo thi wo kehti thi ki maine bhi.
These children just wouldn't go to school. They wouldn't get a chance otherwise. The older these children would, before coming to school, would have been working for some time in the brick kilns. But now there's none of them going to the brick kilns, that they're all coming to school. Unke maa baap, their parents are okay with that?
Koi walden itraz nahi karte, balki unke walden.
So she says the parents are happy to let them come to school. They encourage them to come to school. And which is good to see here, about half are girls, which is different from what we've seen in Sindh with the various schools among the tribal peoples. So that's a good sign, a hopeful sign. And after they finish fifth class, they can go on to the government school. So despite all the, you know, the bonded labour, all the difficulties, the children in other brick kilns who don't go to school, here in this one, it is a small good news story that, you know, the children are getting a chance to go to school, and especially the girls. So that's good.
Yeah.
You mixed bachche hain?
Haan ji, mixed
50-50?
Nahi. 50-50 नहीं है मेरे तकरीबन 70 बच्चे हैं 22 बच्चे जो मुस्लिम हैं
so out of the 70 children more than 22 are Muslim and the rest are Christian. That in itself too is it's a good sign that you know, with all the negative image that's going on about, you know, about religious fighting and in all the destruction and death, suicide bombings that are going on, that at a grassroots level, at a very basic level, they're working together in the brick kilns. Muslim and Christian, the children are studying here in this little school. And this is replicated in the TB clinic, as you've seen in Bedin. It's replicated all over the country. And this is a story that's not being told. The other story is there. It is the present reality of the fundamentalism, of the violence and the ethnic strife and all the suicide bombings that are going on in various parts of the country from time to time. But this is also part of the reality, part of the story, that there are communities are scattered around the country, you know, people living ordinary everyday lives, struggling, you know, working in brick kilns, you know, as bonded labourers, living peacefully side by side with each other. It is a positive step, yeah. It is a hopeful step. The first time leaving home, it was easy because I'd never been to Pakistan before. It was exciting, it was something new, so it lessened the pain of actually having to leave home. But every time now, you know, leaving home has got more difficult as the years go by. When I go home now, I like to spend a lot of time with nieces and nephews, and you get attached, you know, making that break coming back, that's difficult. Elderly parents, my mother's still alive in her 80s. So leaving that situation is difficult. Yes, it's difficult. It's not easy. I still don't know why I do it, but it's, you know, it's still come. Well, in the early years here, there was no internet. The telephone service wasn't very good. The letters were slow. You know, you're much further from home than you are today. You know, now with the internet, you know, things are easier. You know, you're up to date. You know, it can be a bit surreal at times, you know, because when you're reading the newspaper, you can, you know, something happening local at home, you have it in your mind's eye, you know the colours, you know the people involved even sometimes. And then you go outside and you're in a completely different reality. You know, that can be a bit surreal. But we'll get home more regular now than before, which is good also. But when I go home, and especially, you know, I like to say Mass in the local church and offer my services. There I find, you know, to put a sermon together is much more difficult for some reason. You know, where are these people at now? It's a different Ireland than what I left. You know, that I'm not around long enough to be tuned in fully again, to be able to, you know, to speak to, you know, their needs and what's, you know, what's touching their lives. But maybe in some ways, ironically, that's one of the roles of a missionary. I'll never be fully at home in Pakistan. Okay, I blend in, I have a bit of the language, but I'm always a foreigner, you know. And, you know, that's understandable. And going home for a short time, you're never fully at home, you know, enjoy being home. It's great meeting family, friends, catching up, and all of those kind of things. But you're still not fully belonging either. So you're kind of in that in-between space. That's one of the roles of a missionary, being in the in-between space. You know, you're never fully at home where you are, or, you know, or never fully at home again. And that actually can give you an insight to critique what's positive and negative in both places. I think that's one of the gifts. That's one of the that a missionary brings. You know, being the outsider and having the training and the insights and the ability to critique and to name the reality that's going on.
Before leaving Lahore, Tomás stops off at the local Christian cemetery to visit the gravesites of two former Columban fathers from Ireland. Missionaries are often buried in the communities where they served.
That's why we're standing here at the graveside of two Columbans who died within 19 days of each other. Pat McCaffrey, Temple County, Fermanagh, died 18th of May 2010, 66 years of age from a massive heart attack. The next grave beside him, Tom Yohannan, Tarbert, County Kerry, 64 years of age, got a stroke 2 days after Pat's burial, and 12 days in intensive care. He died on the 6th of June, 2010. Two very experienced missionaries. Pat was among the first group to come to Pakistan in 1979 after being 10 years in Fiji. Tom Yohannan was among the second group to come in the early 80s after 10 years or so in the Philippines. A massive blow to the group at the time, you know, a big loss, two very experienced guys, and it's always poignant and moving to come back to, you know, to visit the graves from time to time, to keep the memory alive and be inspired by them to continue the mission here as faithfully and as passionately as possible in in what is a very difficult context. I suppose the dying is more than one kind of dying. As a missionary, when you leave your home and come to another country, you die a lot to home where you grew up. To enter deeply into another culture demands a lot of dying to self also. And there's another kind of dying when here are these two Columbans buried in what is the Columban parish, where Columbus started this parish and have built it up for a good number of years and have now moved on and are no longer in this parish. So they're the living legacy of the work that was done in the parish, and the legacy of, these are kind of the presence here, the burial here, and the soil of Pakistan and the soil of the Punjab province is kind of symbolic of the many ways as missionaries who leave our lives behind us, wherever we are. If I'm asked about what's my relationship, what do I feel about Pakistan, what do I think about Pakistan, what's really my relationship with this country that has spent nearly all of my adult life? An image that comes to me is from the film, Irish film, My Left Foot. Christy and Brown and his mother, played by Brenda Fricker and Daniel Day-Lewis. But there's a scene there in the film where Christy's mother, she looks at him and she says under her breath, Christy isn't here. She says to Christy, sometimes you break my heart, and then sometimes I think you are my heart. And for me, Pakistan has been a difficult, painful place many times because of, the pain and poverty that you encounter each day. And yet, it becomes part of your heart, it becomes part of your life, and that, that in a way is a very, powerful and energizing and life-giving thing.
Bonded Labour, Pakistan's Christian Minority, was produced and narrated by Fergal McCarthy. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.